On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Petroleum Vapor Intrusion, Fundamentals of Screening, Investigation, and Management. My name is Mary Yelkin. I'm coming to you from Lincoln, Nebraska. I will provide some introductory material to help you understand how you can best participate actively today, and then I will turn it over to our trainers from the ITRC Petroleum Vapor Intrusion team. Today's training is based off a technical and regulatory guidance document. It's an online guidance document that if you haven't taken a look at it already, we certainly encourage you to do so. And we expect that this document will then become a resource to you to improve your job performance as you're considering petroleum vapor intrusion issues at sites that you may be working on. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. Just a few items of housekeeping before we get started. We are recording this event, so we can use it as an archive for those who would either like to come back and listen again or for those who aren't able to attend our live offerings. The trainers will be in control of the slides as they move through today's training. If you're someone who would like to control your own slides, you do have an opportunity to download a copy of the slides by going to that initial training page you were directed to when you logged in today. You can also access that through the related URLs over on the right-hand side of your screen. Click on Training Page and then click Browse Too. We want to hear from everyone today as we go through the training. You'll have an opportunity to ask questions. You can type your questions in the Q&A pod, and then during the two designated question and answer periods, we will have an opportunity to ask those questions to the trainers and to get their response. If we do have a situation where we have more questions than we can get to verbally, we will ask the trainers to respond in writing in the Q&A pod. We do want to make sure that we're hearing from everyone and get your feedback today. So there is a feedback form that we will provide at the end of today's training class. That's an online form that you can complete. And if you are someone who needs a certificate of participation to document your continuing education, if you fill out that feedback form, there's a box at the end of that form. If you click on that to certify you participated today and then press submit, a certificate will be generated for you. If you happen to forget to click that box, just go ahead and go into the feedback form again, complete the form, click the box, press submit, and you will receive that certificate. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is hosted by the Environmental Council of States, and we are a network of state regulators working with our federal partners, being the Department of Energy, Department of Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, along with ITRC's affiliates, members of industry, as well as academia and community stakeholders. All these groups come together to work to develop solutions to help people make better decisions when they're working on environmental sites. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website. If you plan to use ITRC materials, we do ask that you review the usage policy and credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty material or endorse any specific products. We do have a large variety of topics that are covered by ITRC guidance documents. You can access those guidance documents online. We also have a lot of different training classes, both online and in the classroom. In the classroom, we have training classes coming up on petroleum vapor intrusion, as well as PFAS. So check out the ITRC website for more information on those opportunities. It's now my pleasure to introduce our trainers today. All of them have been members of ITRC's petroleum vapor intrusion team. If you'd like to learn more about each one of these trainers, you can access their bios through the link provided on this slide. First, we'll be hearing from Matt Williams. He's with the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. And then Georgia Duvall with Shell, Lauren Lund with Jacobs, and David Folks with GeoSynTech Consultants. We'll move now on over to slide number 6, and I will turn it over to Matt Williams with the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. Matt?
Thanks, Mary. On our first slide on slide 6, like Mary said, is today's roadmap. You will see this come in and out through today's presentation to give you an idea where we're at in the process and make it clearer for you to understand how everything fits together. You also will see on the right-hand side that community engagement is involved with all these steps, and that's an important consideration as you consider that we need to make sure that we're informing the people along the way who have the potential to be involved with these investigations. So slide 7 starts us off with what is vapor intrusion. And vapor intrusion is a broader term which describes the process by which volatile vapors partition from the groundwater and migrate up through the soils and into overlying buildings. And you can see three examples of it below. Petroleum vapor intrusion, which is what today's training is focused on, is a subset of vapor intrusion that deals exclusively with petroleum hydrocarbons and not mixed releases, but just petroleum hydrocarbons. And the main difference that you have is aerobic biodegradation. It's the defining feature of PVI, and it's what distinguishes it from CVI or chlorinated vapor intrusion. Petroleum vapor intrusion and biodegradation is the breakdown of chemicals by microorganisms in the vadozone. In these vadozone soils, we find PHC, or petroleum hydrocarbon degrading bacteria, pretty much in all environments, even some of the driest environments that we have, but we'll discuss that a little bit later. In these bacteria consume hydrocarbons in the presence of oxygen. With the biodegradation, it limits the transport and affects the petroleum hydrocarbons, which on previous guidance documents for chlorinated vapor intrusion, it didn't address biodegradation. And therefore, in many cases, what you found was that there was a over-conservatism when you looked at how to screen sites and looking at only the concentration-based approach. On slide 9, this is the effect of what aerobic biodegradation does for petroleum hydrocarbon. That unlike CVI, the vast majority of our sites, when we have a screening process, can be screened out, which would reduce the number of sites that we need to do in-site investigation on, and possibly not even require vapor mitigation. So again, if we can set up a good screening approach, we can reduce the number of sites that we have to investigate, and therefore even further reduce the number of sites that we may have to mitigate. So it is a big deal, petroleum vapor intrusion. And the ITRC document was produced because there was a lack of guidance and training information to support these kind of confident decision-making abilities that we encourage. Our experience with chlorine and vapor intrusion heightened where vapor intrusion was an issue, where when we were looking at petroleum vapor intrusion, we didn't have that urgency because we didn't see as many sites that rose to the level of risk. The purpose of the document is to identify a prioritization process and focus our limited resources on those sites that have the greatest potential for petroleum vapor intrusion to occur. Because there is a huge financial impact, either delays in construction or property transactions, for sites that were unnecessarily going through the investigative process. So the other issue is the potential adverse health effects on building occupants when we do not meet these screening distances where vapors could be present at significantly high concentrations. On slide 11 is the electronic document that you will see in the introduction screen on ITRC's website. It's a web-based document which allows you to provide additional information, provides links. You're more than welcome to look at it. Unlike our previous vapor intrusion document, it includes a lot of the supplemental detail and links on how to actually get there. So if you need things, you will find links explained. You can also find definitions and other presentations as well. ITRC's PVI document relates to the other main documents in that it builds on the original ITRC's vapor intrusion guidance document that was produced in 2007. But that document focused primarily on chlorinated compounds, CVI, and it didn't specifically talk about biodegradation. The ITRC's PVI document also complements the US EPA document that was released in 2015. And the US EPA was a member of the team as we produced the document, and we are aware that they align. However, the EPA's document is limited to only USTs compared to the ITRC document, which has a wider applicability to more types of petroleum sites. And we'll discuss that in a little bit later. Slide 13, so the intent of using the PVI screening method is based on a vertical screening distance. This method will produce consistent and confident decision makings that are protective of human health. It'll minimize the risk and or the investigative efforts at sites where there is little risk. And it also allows states and parties that use this approach to prioritize resources for sites that have the highest potential for risk to occur and where there's the most likely a complete pathway. The ITRC guidance document is a comprehensive strategy for screening, investigation, and managing the PVI sites. It fills in the gaps for petroleum and helps apply the biodegradation. It applies it in a consistent approach for regulators and practitioners when they use it. It brings credibility because it's nationally developed, and it was developed through a consensus-based approach from stakeholders from a large majority of the states and state regulators, national representatives, and as well as representatives from the armed services as well. The approach is based on scientifically. It's based on the latest research. It's still applicable today. It's applicable for also for a large range of petroleum sites, not only underground storage tanks, but larger petroleum sites such as refineries and pipelines. This is an overview of the ITRC's PVI assessment strategy. The strategy includes, in the beginning, a site screening process using the vertical screening distance. It goes on then to a site investigation approach, which will be discussed in further steps. And at the end, for those sites through the site investigation that have determined that be a completed pathway or pose an unacceptable risk, we would then implement a vapor control and site management strategy. And this is figure 1-2 from the ITRC document. You can get to that by clicking on the link below if you have not downloaded it. This is a breakdown on how this goes. The site screening is described in three steps, and George will go through those steps. First step is to develop a preliminary conceptual site model. The next step is to evaluate the site for precluding factors and the lateral inclusion zone. And step three is to screen the building using the vertical separation distance. The next steps, step 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, are more traditional. The more traditional approach. They include conducting the concentration-based evaluation using actual data collected from the site, selecting and implementing the appropriate investigative approach, evaluating the data, determining if additional investigation is warranted, and deciding if the pathway is complete and whether mitigation is necessary. The ITRC document, like we've talked about, goes beyond gas stations. Appendix E provides conceptual site models for other things besides USTs, such as refineries, bulk storage fuel facilities, pipeline and transportation areas, oil exploration, former manufacturing gas plants. And as Mary will pull up from the initial poll, I believe you can see that there is a wide range of sites there, and it looks like pretty much all different sites are represented or included as part of this part, but a large majority still are sitting from the, would be concerned with the USTs. However, it does look like we do have other things like the refineries, where you would look at the different conceptual site models and how it would impact the oil exploration. There's a few of you as well. Thank you, Mary. I'll lower that down. So finally, we talked about the community engagement. On slide 18, obviously any kind of investigation is definitely disconcerting for people, especially vapor intrusion investigations in general, because it's intrusive. You have to get into the structures in the majority of the time. So you need to be prepared to address all different kinds of questions, such as what is PVI, what to expect during an investigation, how is a problem fixed, and is my problem ever over? Those types of questions have been answered. You'll find those in Appendix K. You can get to that appendix by clicking on the link at the bottom of the slide. But we encourage you to look at it, and we'll discuss these more in specific detail as we go through the process with where these fact sheets may be or community engagement sheets may be applicable to use. So after today's training is done, we hope that you have a better understanding on how and where to use ITRC's PVI document. We also hope that you understand the important role that biodegradation plays with the PVI pathway compared to what we've done in the past with chlorinated solvents, and how biodegradation plays an important part in this distance screening method. The value of a PVI conceptual site model is key in going forward and understanding those distances and as they apply, and where you can find the key components. Finally, how you can apply the whole ITRC PVI state process, the ITRC PVI 8-step process, so that you can screen your sites using a consistent approach, that you can take action if your site doesn't initially screen out through either investigating, modeling, vapor control, and or other site management strategies. Plus, we hope that you take away how and when to engage with different stakeholders. So getting back to the roadmap, I will turn the presentation now over to George Duvall.
Thank you, Matt. In this next section, we're going to look at the petroleum vapor intrusion pathway. So in terms of what we're going to cover here, important information around biodegradation and conceptual site model, and the basics of what we're going to cover here in terms of petroleum vapor intrusion are some basics around vapor flow and vapor intrusion. We're going to make some comparisons between petroleum and chlorinated solvents in vapor intrusion, look at biodegradation, how significant it is for petroleum vapor intrusion, including some experimental evidence, and look at this petroleum vapor intrusion conceptual site model. Let's start with the conceptual site model. What you're looking at in the pictures are a couple variations on the conceptual site model. These are all similar. They all have what we'll call four compartments, a building, a foundation which separates the building enclosure from the subsurface soil, a soil layer between the foundation and a subsurface vapor source, and then, of course, the source of vapors in the subsurface, which could be either residual NAPL or groundwater. Now, there's a number of factors listed in the slide related to each of these compartments. Any of these factors could attenuate vapors between the source and the enclosure where people are. What we're really going to focus on here is this aerobic biodegradation, mainly because it's pretty ubiquitous and because the attenuation that we see from this biodegradation is pretty significant. Now, that conceptual site model is looking at subsurface to indoor vapor intrusion. There's a number of different ways that vapors can get into a building aside from that exposure pathway. Could be from outdoor air, could be from vapors from things brought into a house or building like water, groundwater, commercial products. All of these things can result in vapors inside a house. We're not covering these. We're just looking at this particular situation of subsurface vapors through a building foundation into indoor air. And there's, of course, in evaluating a site, there's other potential exposure pathways, things like groundwater ingestion or soil contact and so forth that we do evaluate. They're just not part of this particular exposure pathway. Now, I got a poll question here. Ask Mary to bring that up. And this is just gauging experience with chlorinated vapor intrusion, particularly looking at things like TCE and PCE, dry cleaners, that type of thing. That's fine. I'm going to varied levels of experience. I'm going to keep going. And the picture here, you can in the poll, Mary. The picture here that we're looking at is some figures out of an EPA document. The document itself, the link's on the left side here. It's 8 or 9 pages. Can be worth looking at. The figures that you're looking at are coming out of that document, and the big difference here is the extent of this vapor plume. Vapor plume on the right for chlorinated solvents, pretty extensive. On the left, much more limited. And limited in that we have oxygen in the subsurface, and between the oxygen and the hydrocarbon vapors is this aerobic biodegradation zone, which limits the extent and migration of these petroleum vapors in the subsurface. There's another number of other factors that differentiate these two types of situations, but it's that aerobic biodegradation that seems to be significant in terms of what we see for attenuation. So what do we know about biodegradation of petroleum? We do know that when we have petroleum in soils, we see biodegradation occurs pretty reliably. The microorganisms capable of doing the degradation are pretty ubiquitous, pretty much everywhere. When it occurs, when the soil is exposed initially to petroleum, the degradation starts relatively rapidly, within hours to days. And where there's oxygen in the subsurface, the degradation itself is pretty rapid. Now, that biodegradation occurs with petroleum in soil is pretty widely recognized. There's a number of links to EPA, other regulatory documents in this slide, recognizing the significance of petroleum biodegradation. There's literally, in peer-reviewed literature, hundreds of publications looking at various aspects of petroleum biodegradation. So we do know that it occurs, widely recognized that it occurs. What we're doing here is incorporating that information into how we're actually evaluating, practically evaluating this exposure pathway. Now some basics in terms of what's going on with petroleum biodegradation, aerobic petroleum biodegradation, and this is a simplified cartoon, but it works pretty good. Essentially, what we have is these microbes capable of doing the biodegradation. They're subsisting on petroleum along with oxygen. They produce ultimately hydrocarbon, carbon dioxide, and water, and make more microbes. And that's really the simplicity of this. And it occurs in a lot of different places. Now, the key factors in petroleum vapor intrusion influencing how much attenuation we see are actually pretty limited. What we see this attenuation depend on is the vapors, the concentration of the petroleum vapors we have in the subsurface, the distance over which those are migrating from the source vapors, the NAPL or the groundwater, up to the soil surface, and whether or not we have oxygen in that intervening soil layer. So there's only a few key, there's a lot of other factors here, but those are really the main key factors in influencing how much degradation we see. I'm going to keep that in mind, but move on to this conceptual site model we started with, those four different compartments, and I'm going to step through each of those compartments, starting with vapor source. And what you're looking at is essentially a illustration of the different ranges of constituents by carbon number, the number of carbon molecules the number of carbons in the molecules versus distribution in the fuel. And what you're looking at is various distributions for various types of fuel. There's a box here labeled maximum PVI potential. And what we have here is at the lower limit about carbon number 5 or so. What we have for smaller molecules, more volatile molecules, is that they're so volatile that they don't really persist in the subsurface. Above about C11 or C12, we're looking at molecules which have very low vapor pressure, so there's not very much potential for vapor intrusion. What we have in the middle is just this sweet spot of hydrocarbons that are both volatile and persistent, and really that's what we're talking about as gasoline, as the most significant potential vapor source for petroleum vapor intrusion. Stepping up in that conceptual site model into between the source and the bottom of building foundation, we have a soil layer. And this is an illustration of what's going on in that soil layer. What we generally have is high hydrocarbon concentrations at depth, high oxygen concentrations at the soil surface, this complementary profile of decreasing oxygen concentrations and decreasing hydrocarbon concentrations and where they're coming together. We have what's labeled here an aerobic biodegradation front, where most of the degradation and attenuation occurs. And what's going on in this soil layer can vary. What we can look at is how it varies, for instance, with different hydrocarbon concentrations. Where we have low hydrocarbon concentrations, that aerobic biodegradation front will occur lower in the soil layer, farther away from the soil surface. There's a lot more distance over which that aerobic biodegradation can occur, a lot more attenuation, a lot more potential for attenuation. Where we have high hydrocarbon vapor concentrations, what will happen is that aerobic biodegradation front will occur shallower in the soil layer, closer to the soil surface. In some cases, it can actually intersect the soil surface. And those are the cases where we have the most potential for actual vapor intrusion issues, where we have very low degrees of aerobic biodegradation. And to illustrate some of this, this is actual data. This is from a paper from Matt Lavas 20 years ago. And what you're looking at is measured data for hydrocarbons. In this case, benzene is a surrogate for hydrocarbons and oxygen. And we're seeing this complementary crossing profile of the oxygen and the benzene. Oxygen decreasing down to about a minimum around 4 feet below the soil surface. The hydrocarbon, the benzene here, once it gets into that shallow zone where there is oxygen, decreases pretty rapidly. The benzene scale is actually logarithmic. We see this essentially exponential decay of the benzene. So it's pretty high at depth, but once it gets into the aerobic layer, decreasing very rapidly to really insignificant concentrations near the soil surface. And then this is one example. We have lots of other examples, many, many data sets which show essentially the same thing. What we've done is taken these data sets and essentially extracted rates relative to how fast this degradation is occurring. And that's what's in this plot. And there's actually a lot of information on this plot. It's essentially showing we know just about how fast these rates occur, with some error bars in there for quite a variety of different petroleum constituents. There's a lot of information in this graph. If you actually want more information, you can look in the ITRSA guide. It's described better. But the big picture here is that we have a lot of data. We know how fast these petroleum chemicals degrade when there's oxygen present, and the degradation's fast enough to be significant in this particular exposure pathway. Practically, what's all that data mean? For most soils where we have oxygen present, where they're aerobic, air-connected soils, we're seeing generally, for most of these chemicals, about a factor of 2 decrease in vapor concentrations over distances ranging from 5 to 50 centimeters. And geometrically, similar attenuation over multiples of those distances. So it's significant relative to how far these vapors usually migrate in typical situations. Now, that attenuation will occur when there's oxygen in the subsurface. And a key piece of information is there's actually a lot of oxygen available. There's a lot of oxygen in ambient air. If we take those concentrations of oxygen in ambient air, use the approximate ratio at which hydrocarbon and oxygen are consumed in aerobic biodegradation, about a ratio 1:3, what we see is that the oxygen in air has the capacity to degrade about 92 grams per cubic meter, about 92 million micrograms per cubic meter hydrocarbon vapors. That's a pretty big concentration, so the potential for degrading these hydrocarbons is actually pretty high. Now, to actually have that happen, we need to have the oxygen in the subsurface. There's a couple things that can limit oxygen flow into the subsurface. Can be because we have a building foundation, a low permeability building foundation, limiting flow of oxygen from the atmosphere downwards. Can be because in some situations we can have low soil diffusivity because the soil's wet or has low permeability. We can also have low oxygen concentrations in the subsurface because of oxygen demand. That demand can come from just the presence of petroleum hydrocarbons in the subsurface, high concentrations of petroleum hydrocarbons in the subsurface, or other sources of oxygen demand, things like high organic content in soils. So two different factors that might limit oxygen in the subsurface. But generally, what we see in most situations is that even low rates of oxygen transport are sufficient to give us enough aerobic biodegradation in most cases to attenuate these vapors significantly. So in most cases, we generally don't have issues. And so what we get to, and I'm starting to wrap this up, is a revised conceptual site model. In this case, we've got the same compartments, but what's added here in this case is the oxygen from the subsurface. So oxygen diffusing downward from open soil surfaces through building foundations, and this added aerobic biodegradation zone surrounding the petroleum vapors, limiting its extent, and changing our interpretation of what's going on here. So I covered a lot of technical information so far, high level, but technical information. There's other issues around vapor intrusion and petroleum vapor intrusion, particularly dealing with neighbors, dealing with the community. Some relevant questions on this slide that can come up. We're in neighborhoods, we're in people's houses. I'm going to direct you to the ITRC guide, which has a lot of good supporting information in answering these and other types of similar questions when these issues come up. And with that, I'm going to go to a summary, which is what we've covered, essentially looking at that conceptual site model for petroleum vapor intrusion, the different compartments, the significance of petroleum biodegradation, some sorting and supporting information for that, key influence of having oxygen in the subsurface and how that affects degradation. And lastly, looking at these community engagement questions. And with that, I'm returning this to Matt.
Thanks, George. So we're back at today's roadmap. Well, hopefully that's a little bit better. I had it on speaker instead of on my headset. So we're back at today's roadmap. And we're going to go move into the site screening. The interesting part of this in the site screening is I work for the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. I am a co-leader for the ITRC classroom-based training, as well as the internet-based training. And George did a great job, I think, introducing you to the science behind the site screening. If you want more information,
please check out the document. Like George said, there's a lot of other great information and resources for you there. The reason I bring up that I'm a state regulator is I think that this is the key section to this vertical or to this screening distance process is the site screening. And I will tell you throughout this process when we were developing it, there were multiple states involved in addressing this. And a lot of us came a little bit skeptical about what the science is. And we went through and we researched a lot of it ourselves, and we became very avid believers in this process. And I'm going to give you a kind of an overview of some of that site screening and some of the evaluations that we did and looked at it and how it convinced us that this site screening process is valid. And so I want to start things out a little bit going through what we're going to cover in this next process up to our first question and answer break, but kind of describe the conceptual site model that George just talked about, summarize some of the empirical basis for the screening process that kind of gave the state regulators that were part of this group that comfort level that this is a valid approach to doing this. And then I'm going to actually describe the stepwise approach, go through the first three steps that we talked about, and then provide a case study example of that went through this approach and how we can screen something out. We hope that you learn in this section the basis for the site screening and how to implement the state this three-step part of the process and apply this approach at different PVI sites using a case study that we're going to show here. But again, if you need more information, there's a lot more detailed information about the science behind this approach in the document, and we definitely encourage you to check that out. So to start with, the site screening, it's a new method for PVI screening because it's based on the vertical screening distance. This is a little bit different than when we looked at chlorinated vapor intrusion because we're looking at a distance-based approach versus a concentration-based approach. And this is based on the empirical data that's in some analysis and modeling studies that was done by numerous people. And so the one thing that is clear based on all these different studies is the consistency at which the same answer was drawn. And I think that that's a big key factor for many of the state regulators that were involved with this, is there just didn't seem to be even any hiccups to this approach, that all the data supported this. So the approach is expected to improve PVI screening and reduce where we have to collect the data. And that's the other key thing, is this is to focus where we need to start the vapor intrusion screening process and focus limited resources on those houses or those structures or those buildings that may most likely be at risk from vapors, from petroleum vapor intrusion. So the concept of the vertical screening distance, there are three different depths that the ITRC document identifies. One is the 15 feet to LNAPL sources, and that's if you have a petroleum UST or an AST site, it identifies 15 feet from the NAPL, and it doesn't matter if it's residual. And then you can see under the LNAPL source that it includes residual LNAPL in the soil in the smear zone. So identifying and being able to characterize where the NAPL is very important to this process. The document does identify 18 feet for industrial sites, and the 18 feet is more of that conservative factor because the data, we just didn't have enough data to support going down to the 15 feet, so we went a little bit more conservative and added the 3 feet. It looks like the data still is very similar, but we added that conservative factor. And when we get to the dissolved source, we're only looking at a 5 foot separation distance. And you can see in the conceptual site models on the right how that vertical separation distance applies. And it's from the bottom of your structure. So if you're in a state that has a basement, you really need to know the bottom of your structure. And that again helps with that site characterization. It's because you need to know how the building's built. And it's not just from ground level, even though that's kind of what our conceptual site model shows right here. So the basis of the screening, like George talked about, there's a large body of empirical data that's out there. It was collected when we were looking at it between 1995 and 2011. And there was a whole bunch of paired measurements in which they did vapor samples with actually indoor air. And you could actually, and we could get an idea of where the, what the relationship was, as well as whether it was from elm apple or what was the likely source of that, those vapor concentrations. And that data came from hundreds of petroleum sites across the United States, as well as Australia can provided a good subset of those as well. But throughout all those data, all that data that was collected, it showed that there was a significant portion of biodegradation that occurred within short distances, and that you could clearly see that the vapors didn't extend like we saw in the chlorinated vapor intrusion world, that we saw that those distances from where the vapor source was to the building was significantly less. Most of the data we looked at was gasoline station sites, which again is why we added the 3 feet for conservatism on the industrial sites. The analysis that was conducted for the sites involved dissolved phase sites, Allen Apple at UST sites, and then like there was some done for the petroleum industrial sites as well. The US EPA database had a number of sites. They had 74 sites across the United States, so you can see that there was a wide range of soil types that were considered. Not every state's representative, but the general conditions apply. I'm from Michigan. We didn't have any sites in the EPA database, but we're very similar to what we see in like Minnesota and some of the other northern states as well. You can also see they had similar sites in the south as well, in the east and west, and they saw all different things. There's a list of references. If you go to the document, it actually will link you to the actual reports itself where the data was collected. Robin Davis did a lot of this work, and probably is one of them that started kicking off a lot of it. But in all, in the U.S., there was 893 benzene vapor measurements that were done as part of this analysis. When you look at the Australian data set, it brought in another 124 sites with over 1,000 measurements more to this analysis. So it's a pretty strong database when we look at it, Nation, when we look at that full data set and where it came from and all the different environments. And it's all the same conclusion. But in 548, it also shows you that there were some other analysis of the other compounds. Benzene, by far, was the one that was most analyzed. Some of the other ones, like some of the additives, you see like 2,2,4-trimethylpentane, there just wasn't a lot of data that was collected for some of those, which is why there's some of those restrictions. Or when we talk about some of the exclusions, you'll see that that will come into play as well. But there was a large amount, mainly benzene in the data set. On slide 49, talks about the empirical data analysis. So soil vapor concentrations compared to a risk-based threshold, this is a vertical distance one. So it's vertical, we're not applying a concentration-based, but in order to make this analysis, we went through that evaluation. We looked at the concentrations, what risk-based concentrations were, where they were at, where they degraded, like George talked about, where we saw that breakdown from being posing an unacceptable risk to sites that posed a risk. And on slide 50, this slide truly does have a lot of information on it for you. So I'm going to try to walk you through it a little bit. It's a dissolved source, so this has already been screened. We're not looking at elm apple for the most part. When you look at distances, you'll see the distances across the bottom. You'll see a dashed line with where the 5 foot depth is represented on the whole screen. And what you can see is up above the two green lines, those are the risk-based concentrations that you see. And what you can see is that on the left-hand side, less than 5 feet, that's where we see all the risk. When we have distances greater than 5 feet, vertical separation distance, as shown in that conceptual site model, from a dissolved source, we didn't see any kind of risk-based concentrations that exceeded. There are two in this graph, but when you actually look at it, there was some questions whether it was a site characterization possibly more than it was associated with a true risk. But when you looked at the data, it was pretty clear that if we had this 5 foot separation distance for a dissolved source and you had well characterization, a good characterized site, that there is a very low potential of a risk, and this is a huge amount of data that came through this process. And when we looked at the confidence level that we had, I mean, you can see from the probability in these confidence levels, again, there was a very high confidence level that we had that there was a very low potential of any risk being involved. And that's very rare for when we do these kind of studies. I mean, usually we're hoping for 70% or whatever, but when we're looking at the confidence levels and they're all, these probabilities are so high, you know, we definitely left with a much better feeling at the end of the process and more confident than when we started the process, just because the data was so positive that this distance-based approach was successful. When you looked at the LNAPL, again, you see the same thing. It's the same chart, but here's your LNAPL sources that you have. You have the conceptual site model on the right-hand side of the screen that shows you that vertical separation distance of 15 feet. And this is considering all NAPL sources again, you know, residual NAPL, mobile NAPL. And if you look at where all the risk-based concentration was, that's above that green line, it is less than 15 feet from the source. And that, again, that's such a huge confidence level that when we can draw those lines and make these conclusions, that we didn't see any outliers. And when we looked at the state, and I can tell you from Michigan, we pulled up our sites as well, we started to run them through this kind of probability, and we saw the same curves matching. And it gave us the confidence to go forward as well, that we were seeing these kind of things. And in fact, we started to plan some of our investigations to test these theories where we knew there was NAPL, to see if we would see these concentrations, and we didn't. So it is well supported by science. I think the data supports it, and I think when we did the analysis, we had that great confidence level. And here's, again, just kind of that conditional probability that, again, you see when that 15-foot distance is, we have a very good confidence level that when we meet these vertical separation distances, there is just a low probability of there being a vapor risk. So the focus of this is to focus our investigation primarily on those sites that you can't screen out, where you don't have 15 feet distance from, where you're within 15 feet from the NAPL, where you're within 5 feet from the dissolved source. Those are where we focus our investigation first. Start there. In some sites, you know, Michigan's got a lot of shallow groundwater, I can tell you, and I speak from experience. Sometimes we're not able to screen a lot of our sites out because of that, but in portions of our state, this does help quite a bit in focusing where we need to start. On slide 54, what this slide basically talks about is the screening levels. And depending on what your screening level for your state is, what you see is when you meet these screening distances that it is protective regardless of what your screening level is, because we see such rapid biodegradation and such a reduction in concentration. And I think that's the big takeaway from this slide, is it doesn't really matter what your soil gas concentration is. What's more important is it NAPL or is it dissolved? In some states, and that was a big thing that we discussed too, and you can see in the ITRC PVI document, every state talks about how they define, and I think the document does a good job too, describing different ways to discuss what NAPL is and what NAPL isn't and what dissolved is and what it isn't. And that's part of what you need to make sure that you're aware of, is does your state consider it NAPL or not? On slide 55, this is the first two steps of the site screening process, and we're going to walk through them. So step one is develop your CSM for the site screening. And step two is, are there any precluding factors present? And we'll discuss what those are here in a little bit more detail. So step one, develop a conceptual site model. We talked about how in the appendix, if your site is on a petroleum one, that there are other conceptual site model documents there to help you develop a conceptual site model and identify what the key features are. There is, for PVI, the site type is important. Understanding the petroleum vapor source, where it's at, the extent of the source. We'll talk about the precluding factors in the next step. The lateral inclusion zone, and the vertical separation distance, being able to visualize those conditions, how the buildings are, understanding how the building's constructed is an important component, because that is one thing that differs definitely across the United States, is how buildings are constructed in the southern U.S. is very different than how things are constructed in the northern. In the northern areas, we have a lot more basements and a lot more sub-basements and things like that. It is different, but when you look at the process and the distances, being able to visualize those, put those together in a very visual representation of what your site is, helps this process go through. So that's step one. Again, understanding your petroleum, whether it's a UST or AST site, whether you're using service stations, an industrial site. Again, look at the appendix in the back of the ITRC PVI document. That document will help you develop your conceptual site model. Look at the petroleum vapor source. Table 3.1 of the document discusses whether different options or different states and how they look at LNAPL versus dissolved phase concentrations. You can also use multiple lines of evidence in some states, whether there are direct indicators such as LNAPL and Sheen, whether you may have some indirect indicators like PID readings or high concentrations. There's also things like the shaker test and other things like that that would give you lines of evidence to indicate whether NAPL is present or not. Again, this is probably something more state-specific than it is nationwide. You'd have to look at what your state would allow for a multiple line of evidence approach. As an LNAPL source, sites with free phase or residual, sometimes that residual LNAPL is difficult to detect, and that's important to understand as well. So again, characterization of the site becomes a key component. Here's the indicators that are in the 3.1, but again, you can go through it to go through. You can just get an idea whether there's different indicators of NAPL being present. Benzene, you can see, usually has a concentration greater than 1 to 5 milligrams per liter. This is focused more on the benzene and the TPH components. I would encourage you, again, to look at your state, make sure that you understand what they require. There's different indicators in soil as well. You know, and location definitely plays a respect to where NAPL is located as well. You're going to expect the NAPL to be adjacent to where the release occurred or near, right? You're not going to typically find NAPL in a large amount migrating from the source. Again, most of it, especially for our underground storage tank sites, you're going to find very near to where the source of the petroleum was. The extent of the source, defining it, delineation again is key. So having a good conceptual site model, this is not going to be one of those things that you can have one boring in the general area. You need to know where the NAPL is and where it's not. You need to know the top of the LNAPL in groundwater, the soil. You need to know the smear zone. If you're dealing with groundwater, how much it fluctuates. Also for dissolved plume, you need to really know that edge and the defining edge of where that dissolved concentration is. Precluding factors are things that will prevent us from using this approach. There are different pathways, like if you have a fractured geology or karst terrain, because you don't have soil for this to go through. It will go through a fracture directly into your home. Portions, and I use Michigan as an example. Again, we have bedrock, and we have basements that are in bedrock. So we actually have federal fractured geology that goes right up to the house. So there are other ones like poorly sealed utility lines where the petroleum gets in the sewer line and there's a direct conduit to the house. You also, another one would be an advancing or expanding plume because the release is still ongoing. You can see ITRC's LNAPL site management document for some of the decision process or remedial technologies to help you through those steps. But you're not at the point, if you're going through that process, you're not at looking where vapor intrusion is. You have a much bigger issue to address with. There are certain fuel types that are precluding factors, such as those with lead scavengers or that have high ethanol. And a lot of that has to do with that there just isn't the data that's out there for us when we did this document to look and assess those. ITRC also has a new document out, biofuels, that was released in 2011. That may help with some of these with the higher ethanol preservation or higher ethanol content so that you can assess where those are at as well. So if you have any of those precluding factors, like fracture geology that I talked about, karst, the direct conduits with the pathways, you're automatically, you can't use this vertical distance approach. So that is an important concept when you go through it, and it is part of step two. Step one, again, develop the conceptual site model. This is important because you need to know the edge of the dissolve phase, because from the edge of the dissolve phase, that's where your lateral inclusion zone is, and we look for homes or structures 30 feet beyond the end of the dissolve phase. So that's where we're going to start looking at the vertical distances. We're going to look at where the dissolve phase ends. We're going to add 30 feet to it, and all those structures inside that is one that we're going to look at the vertical screening distance. So this is a key component as well. The vertical separation distance we've talked about, this is where we're going to start applying it. It's measured from the top of the petroleum source to the bottom of the building foundation. So if you have a basement, that distance is going to go deeper into the soil. It's not a factor of where the ground level is. It is where the soil, the depth to the bottom of the foundation is where you would start it, to the top of the source. Step two, evaluate the building for precluding factors and the lateral inclusion. So again, step two, we're going to look at those precluding factors from the previous slides. If they're present, that's going to kick us out. If there are no precluding factors, we're going to determine the edge of the building foundation. Is it within that lateral inclusion zone, which is 30 feet from the edge of the petroleum source? And finally, step three is where we're going to do, this is where the vertical separation distance comes into play. We've identified all the structures that are in our lateral inclusion distance. Now we're going to apply the vertical separation distance. And again, for petroleum, when we're looking at LNAPL, we're talking 15 feet from the bottom of the foundation to the top of the residual or the top of the NAPL, 18 feet for industrial sites. And for dissolved phase sources, we're only looking at a distance of 5 feet. So when we look at this, you can see that there is a big difference when we're talking about NAPL with 15 feet, being able to reduce it for our dissolved phase sources of only 5 feet. So the case study is brought to you by Robin Davis of the Utah DEQ. And it's a site where, as an example, that Robin saw quite a bit of. And so it was one of the first steps when we went through this to look at whether these distances made sense. So the step one was she went out and developed the CSM, and you can see a representation here out in the top right corner. You can see it's a house which has an actual basement. So, and you can see that the basement is 7.72 feet above a dissolved source of ground of benzene. So there is that 5 foot separation distance when we know. So when we looked at it, are there precluding factors? Well, there was no preferential pathways. There was no utilities or anything that directly intersected the source. The plume for this site was stable. It was found to be shrinking. There were no lead scavengers. It was a release. Didn't contain high amounts of ethanol. So we didn't have any of the precluding factors. And it was within the lateral inclusion distance because you can see that benzene, if we did our normal calculations of a risk-based approach, that benzene would probably in most states represent an unacceptable risk in groundwater. So this house was definitely in it. So the question is there sufficient vertical separation distance? And you can see from the conceptual site model that for this structure there was. I could tell you that many of the homes that we've investigated in the initial phases, we collected data in these to confirm it, and that's partially why this process has been supported, is the data supported that this distance. So if this was our site now in Michigan going forward, we would not require a vapor intrusion or vapor samples to be collected. We may require a land or use restriction, but we wouldn't require that vapors are collected in this site. So with that, I think I'm going to turn it back over to Mary
for All right, thanks, Matt.
Questions.
Yep, we do have time for questions and answers. If you do have a question, you're welcome to type your question in the Q&A pod in the lower right corner of your screen. If you are on a phone line and you'd like to ask your question out loud, we'll give you an opportunity here in just a few moments to ask your question out loud, and it'll be #6 to unmute for those of you that are on the phone lines. Just a reminder that at the end of today's training class, we would like everybody to fill out the online feedback form to give us some feedback on how the training went today. For those of you that do need documentation of continuing education, we do ask that you complete the online feedback form. There's a box at the end of the form for you to click to certify you participated. Once you do that and submit the form, a certificate will be generated for you. If you happen to forget to click the box to certify your participation, just go ahead and go back into that feedback form, click the box, press submit, and you will receive that certificate. Are there any questions from our phone line audience? Okay, we'll go ahead and move on to some written questions. It says, you talked about benzene as a sign of hazard. Are there other chemicals to worry about as far as hazard? How do we know that dissolved PVI at greater than 5 feet won't have other chemicals of concern in PVI?
George, you want to handle this one?
Sure. In terms of dissolved phase, we're looking at a soluble hydrocarbon plume from a gasoline source that's potentially BTEX, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylenes. So it's not that benzene's the only hazard. There's potentially other chemicals in a dissolved phase source. In terms of looking at the attenuation from that dissolved phase source through a soil layer, all these hydrocarbons will degrade, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and so forth. They will degrade to a target soil gas concentration acceptable for further migration in the indoor air. It's just that the benzene, because it's a potential carcinogen, because the inhalation criteria is a lot more stringent than these other chemicals, tends to be the driving chemical in an assessment. We're looking at all the chemicals in a risk assessment, in developing the screening distances. It's just that the benzene tends to be the driver. An extension of that is looking at the NAPL source. Again, benzene tends to be the driver, but there's usually a broader range of chemicals that are potentially in the source. The aliphatics tend not to be soluble in water. You don't see a whole lot of trimethylpentane, for instance, in a groundwater source, not very soluble, but it'll be in a NAPL source. Again, it's that those chemicals do attenuate. They may attenuate slower, and I think there's some slides further that illustrate that. Attenuate slower than benzene. It's just that relative to screening levels, it's usually the benzene that's the driver.
This next question gets at location and climate, and it says, based on your experience, can vertical distance be applied to petroleum sites that may be, say, like in Canada, for example?
So I can speak to that because they are our neighbors, right? So from being the northern states of Michigan, we do apply those distances, and we've seen data that supports that. Like George said, where we find issues tend to be with the additives, for lack of a better term, but those tend to be more associated in the NAPL areas and not so much in the dissolved. Where we do have that separation distance, we have seen our data align with this vertical separation distance approach.
And yeah, Matt talked, I mean, Ontario's kind of same
region
latitude as Michigan. We've done measurements a lot further north than that, up past Edmonton. Measured profiles, saw degradation in the winter as significant as in the summer. This degradation's pretty ubiquitous. That wasn't a place that did have groundwater. You know, might be a little different when we start talking about permafrost, but yeah, as long as you have groundwater, yes, we're seeing the degradation.
Okay, we'll move on to the next question. It says, why is there the 15 or 18-foot distance for elm apple versus the 5 feet for dissolved phase? Is this just because of the effective concentration of chemicals is greater in napple?
I'll take a shot at it. I mean, the picture is that what's significant in the attenuation is the biodegradation. It depends on the oxygen availability. When we have napple, the total hydrocarbon concentrations, they're all degradable. The total hydrocarbon concentrations tend to be a lot higher than for the vapors off the dissolved phase. Because they're higher off the napple, there's more oxygen demand. The anaerobic zone tends to be thicker, more significant, so there's less room for the attenuation. The practical distance, you know, might be a little less than the 15 or 18 foot, just looking generally at the data. It's a little bit higher in those cases also because the data set itself is fairly limited. There's not a lot of UST sites with huge extensive napple plumes. They tend to be bigger sites, terminals, refineries, and so forth. There's just not as many out of them where we have the data. The distances might be a little bit higher than the 12, 13 feet, 15, 18 feet tends to be more conservative. And in terms of those numbers, both the 15, 18 foot for the napple and the 5 foot, they're intended by themselves to be conservative. Most sites will pass. There's not a need for additional conservatism on top of the 15 to 18 feet. It's already conservative. If you look at the data and the slides that Matt had shown, there are sites in that data set where the acceptable distance is zero. There's no vapors there. Now, that's not conservative. It's just what the data's saying. These 15, 18-foot numbers, the 5-foot numbers, are intended to be conservative for screening purposes.
Yeah, and I'll back up what George said, too. And I think the other thing that may get lost here a little bit is we had a large group of state stakeholders, state representatives and state, as well as federal parties involved, EPA, OUST was there as well. And even though we talk about consensus, this is definitely one where we went and we thought we had a very conservative distance with the 15 and 18 feet. And it wasn't like we were having to fight to get that distance. It was one that was readily accepted by everybody there, that the data clearly supported that these distances were conservative. In fact, like George even said, I almost expected, like, the argument to be even trying to push it further, but everybody just—it was a number that everybody agreed with, and it because the data was so conclusive.
All right, we do need to move on to the second portion of our presentation. We will get to more questions and answers at the end. So let's now move on over to slide number 69. And I will turn it over to Lauren Lund with Jacobs to talk about investigation and modeling. Lauren?
Thank you, Mary. So I'm going to click us over to slide number 70. Chapter 4 of the document, it is titled Site Investigation. It does describe this 5-step process for investigating PVI, and that's for sites where the site screening that Matt just discussed in Chapter 3 did not eliminate PVI from further consideration. Let's go to slide 71. So one or more lines of evidence, they're typically required during a site investigation, and this is what we refer to as multiple lines of evidence. The 5-step process that we've outlined in Chapter 4's decision flowchart, it is based on multiple lines of evidence approach. And it's up to you as the investigator to collect and understand the different types of data and the information that you do need. It is important to focus the investigation only on the data and the lines of evidence that you need in order to assess and address PVI. So the site investigation starts with step 4, And this is a concentration-based evaluation where you're using existing data. If the pathway is not eliminated, then you move to step five, and it involves selecting the applicable conceptual site model scenario along with the corresponding sampling approach. The data are then evaluated in step six, and since PVI is an iterative process, you as the investigator determine in step seven whether you need additional investigation or whether it's warranted. The final step involves determining if the pathway is complete. These steps that I just went through are outlined in Figure 4.1, and that we have provided as a handout that you can download. Now, one comment is to remember the decision to implement vapor controls that we describe in Chapter 6, and you'll hear about that shortly. The decision to do that in lieu of further site investigation, you really can make that decision anytime in the process. So we're on slide 73 now. This slide summarizes step four, and that's where you can compare your existing concentrations with screening levels. These screening levels do vary by state, region, and stakeholder. Check with your local regulatory agency for the applicable screening levels. You can also refer to the ITRC Spring 2012 PVI State Survey, which we've summarized in Appendix A of the guidance. Now, you may want to, like I say, check with your regulators because screening levels do get updated and potentially revised. Comparing with the screening levels can help you determine if you do need to conduct additional PVI investigations. And I do want to point out that this concentration-based screening step, it is independent of the vertical screening distance method that Matt just described for Chapter 3. So step 5, it involves selecting the scenario that best fits your site, and along with designing your investigative approach. So your petroleum site should fit under either Scenario 1, and that's where contamination is not in contact with the building, or Scenario 2, where contamination is in contact with the building. Now, I will say there are a few other scenarios that I'll mention, and the type of investigation approach or the strategy that you select, it will depend on the scenario that's specific to your site. Regulatory agencies, they often do have requirements or guidance that's specific to investigating the VI pathway, or they may rely solely on EPA's guidance. And understanding these applicable regulatory guidance really is an important part of designing a successful investigation. So on step five then, this is where we do not have contamination in contact with the building. We would expect that the initial investigation approach, it's going to most likely be soil gas sampling, since those soil gas data that you collect, they really are reflective of the faint transport processes that do occur in the vato zone that George did a good job describing for us. And they can include things such as partitioning, sorption, biodegradation. There are some alternative approaches, and those could include collecting groundwater, soil, subslab soil gas data, or indoor and outdoor air data as well. So scenario two is where your contamination is in direct contact with the building. Under those circumstances, it may not be possible to collect subslab soil gas samples because of your soil saturation. So we would expect that the initial investigation approach, it will most likely be indoor air or crawl space sampling and concurrent outdoor air sampling. But there are alternative and less common approaches that you could use, and they could include collecting samples within the slab or even using flux chambers. You could also collect sump water samples or headspace vapor samples if those sumps are present. However, I have found over the years that interpreting these data can be technically challenging, so make sure you get consensus with your regulators and your stakeholders on how the data collected using these alternative approaches will be interpreted. So let's talk for a moment about other scenarios or special cases. This slide shows that if you do, for example, happen to have intermittent petroleum odors, and assuming that's not an emergency situation, that the initial investigative approach would most likely be a building walkthrough or followed by indoor air sampling to verify the presence of those petroleum hydrocarbons. If you do verify the presence of petroleum hydrocarbons, then a more detailed investigation may be necessary. For undeveloped lots, those lots without buildings, the groundwater, soil, or soil gas methods that I discussed for scenario one would apply since the structure is not there. If preferential pathways are suspected with existing buildings, the initial investigation approach will most likely be indoor air sampling, but some alternatives for that with potential significant preferential pathways may include soil gas sampling within the utility bedding, soil permeability testing, or direct utility conduit air sampling. And then in cases where you have commingled plumes, we would refer you to the methods that are described in the ITRC 2007 VI guidance. So we're on slide number 78 now. And I wanted to take just a moment on this slide to remind folks about the toolbox in Appendix G of the guidance. It is a great resource. It provides many more details on the site investigation methods than what we could include in Chapter 4. And it does answer many of the what, how, and why questions. It includes videos, some step-by-step instructions. It lists analytical methods and provides much more. So I do highly recommend you or your contractors take the time to review the appendix, especially during the work planning phase. So now let's move to step six, and this is the data evaluation step, where the completeness and the significance of the pathway are assessed. Make sure you do consider data quality, and that includes things like detection limits and other potential sampling errors. The multiple lines of evidence evaluation steps that I show here, they're described in quite a bit more detail in the 2007 ITRC VI guidance. And they can include things such as comparing your concentrations with screening levels, based on default assumptions, or those screening levels may be based off of empirical data or modeled attenuation. It is important to determine whether the published screening values that can often be looked up have accounted for bioattenuation of the petroleum hydrocarbons for the reasons that both George and Matt have discussed. So make sure that you're looking at that and considering whether site-specific attenuation factors should be incorporated or calculated. And that's because for many of the sites, as we've all discussed, we find that the petroleum VI issue is not an issue if you have bioattenuation and you've properly accounted for it. Also, remember to account for potential biases if you're sampling indoors, for example, that may be introduced because of background sources when you're evaluating those indoor air data. Make sure you're also looking at both the individual and the cumulative strength of your lines of evidence. So we're on slide 80 now, and this is step 7, and it does reflect the iterative nature of the investigation process when you're determining whether the site's been adequately characterized and whether additional investigation is warranted. Some of the other questions that you'll want to think about include whether the site contaminants have been properly delineated, whether PVI has been assessed at all of the potentially affected buildings, whether there are sufficient data to reach a vapor control decision at the site. If you do conclude that there are some data gaps, it may be necessary to collect some additional data using the methods I just described, or you could refer to Appendix G for some additional tools that include things such as evaluating the building construction, the HVAC operations, and vapor flux. Once you've determined that sufficient data have been collected, the final step then in the site investigation process is to determine the completeness of the pathway. So if the pathway is incomplete, then you can conclude no further evaluation is necessary. However, if it is potentially complete and it has that potential for unacceptable risks, you should consider implementing the vapor control approaches from Chapter 6 that we'll discuss shortly. So I want to provide a case study now in the next few slides. This is another site in Utah. It's a gasoline diesel site in Salina, Utah, provided again by Robin Davis from Utah Department of Environmental Quality. The groundwater is at 20 feet below ground surface. The site has a silty sand and fine-grained sand lithology. The petroleum hydrocarbon releases were from dispensers, product lines, and USTs. So now, steps 1, 2, and 3 from Chapter 3, the site screening, involved developing that preliminary conceptual site model that Matt discussed, determining that there were no precluding factors, and that the building was within 30 feet laterally from the dissolved and the El Napo sources. This led to the conclusion that the PVI pathway could not be eliminated. And that was because the top of the Napo was 5 feet below the slab. And so there was not sufficient separation, vertical separation. Therefore, further investigation was warranted. And a concentration-based evaluation, which is step 4, was conducted and indicated that the benzene near slab soil gas levels, they did exceed the EPA vapor intrusion screening levels, and they exceeded those levels by multiple orders of magnitude. Therefore, it was necessary at this site to proceed to step 5 in the site investigation process. So remember, step 5, you needed to identify and determine which scenario this building fell under. And it fits the scenario where contamination is not or was not in contact with the building. And that's shown here with the red circle on the left. So concurrent subslab soil gas, indoor air, and outdoor air sampling was selected as the investigative strategy for this site. Sampling was conducted during two separate phases, two separate events. Although step 6, or the data evaluation step, determined that the indoor air and outdoor air non-detect concentrations were greater than a 10⁻⁶ target risk level, both the detected and the non-detected indoor air concentrations were similar to the 1 to the minus 5 vapor intrusion screening levels that are used by Utah DEQ. The folks at Utah DEQ also noted that the indoor and outdoor air concentrations were relatively similar, and that suggested the possibility of a background outdoor air source. So over the years, we found that sites like these, where their sub-slab concentrations are at these levels, they do really represent a very low source strength, particularly given the amount of bioattenuation that's expected. So let's go then to step 7, and we're on slide number 88. It was concluded during step 7 that additional investigation was not warranted. During step 8, it was concluded that the PVI pathway was not complete, and that's because indoor air concentrations were similar to the applicable risk-based screening levels. They were non-detect, or they were similar to the outdoor air concentrations. So the vapors have significantly bioattenuated from the relatively shallow Napo source and for this particular case study, and the measured indoor air concentrations were concluded to be likely due to the background sources. I wanted to take just a moment to remind you that it is important to engage your stakeholders and do that throughout the investigation process. So I'm listing on this slide some of the likely questions that the building occupants and other stakeholders will ask during a PVI investigation. And we can all say with experience, things will go much more smoothly if you are proactive and you answer these questions, address the questions early in the process. We do have a chapter in the document, Chapter 7, with many more details on engaging the community or your stakeholders. So in summary, on slide 90, make sure you know your applicable regulatory requirements for PVI investigations. Take a multiple lines of evidence approach. Go ahead and apply the five-step process that I just summarized and that is outlined in the decision flow chart. Make sure you're utilizing Appendix G, the toolbox, as a guide to the expected or your alternative investigation methods. And make sure you're communicating with your stakeholders. So I'll go ahead now and turn the time back over to George for a discussion of the modeling section.
Thanks, Lauren. For the next few minutes, we're going to talk a bit about modeling, specifically petroleum vapor intrusion modeling. So what this is intended to be is a short review of the modeling processes, the steps that one would go through in terms of undertaking the modeling. I'm going to describe something called a biovapor, a spreadsheet-based model for making some of the estimates model estimates. Look at a couple case studies with this biovapor model. The intent here is not an in-depth discussion of modeling. It's covering the highlights. This is mainly going to be useful if you're reviewing models, submitted models. If you want more information or looking for information on how to do this or some more details, I'm going to direct you to this ITRC guide as in the bottom of this slide. So what do you use models for petroleum vapor intrusion? A couple things listed here. We can use it to estimate risks or hazard, to come up with screening criteria, look at various key factors affecting issues in particular sites. One thing we can use these for is for remedial design. For instance, how much oxygen might we need in a specific situation to attenuate vapors. One specific instance that's pretty useful is where we're looking at future use of a property, where a building doesn't exist. In that case, the modeling can be pretty useful. It's also useful in terms of supporting some of the information you've already heard in terms of exclusion or screening distances. Now, in terms of modeling, there's different kinds of modeling. We've got them grouped here in terms of three levels of detail. First one being empirical. We talked about screening distances based on data. That in fact is a model. Screening criteria on concentration, that's based on model. Attenuation factors that some states and regions use in terms of looking at attenuation from subsurface to indoor air, those are based on data. That's a simple model. Those are all simple models. The second level that we're looking at is the biovapor model I talked about. The Johnson and Ettinger model gets some broad use in vapor intrusion studies. They're essentially algebraic equations based on parameters from site data, different level of model. Pretty simple, but a little more complicated than the wholly empirical models in the first bullet. And then lastly, some models can get pretty complicated, numerical, multi-dimensions, time-dependent. These can be useful in very complex situations. They do take a lot of effort, take a lot of data, cost a lot of money. They're actually practically rarely used. They are useful in terms of looking at sensitivities, looking at various effects, and in research applications. So what do models get used for? In different regulatory programs for different reasons. We do have some information available. Massachusetts did a survey a few years ago, and the reasons vary. Sometimes, in a number of states, modeling all by itself is sufficient for evaluating vapor intrusion pathway. In some cases, it's one of a number of multiple lines of evidence. And in some cases, if it gets used, and depending on the results, it may require some confirmatory samples to confirm that we're in the right range in terms of what the model is predicting. So lots of different potential applications depend on where you're at. This slide illustrates a framework for using modeling, petroleum vapor intrusion modeling, although it can be more general. The steps can be more general. Essentially, what we want to make sure is that we've defined the problem we're trying to model, the objective of the model. We want to make sure the conceptual site model matches what the model is actually capable of doing, that they're internally consistent. The biovapor model I mentioned, for instance, does a good job of modeling this subsurface source, vapors through soil, into indoor air. There's situations it doesn't handle, things like preferential pathways, flow through karst, fractured bedrock, some of the stuff that Matt brought up. Another example would be landfill gas, out of scope for what we're talking about, but something that's more complicated than and doesn't match the conceptual model for what we've been talking about. We want to make sure we got the applicable model inputs, the right building characteristics, the other site characteristics that are representative for the model. If possible, we want to compare our model predictions to what's actually going on in the field through data. That comparison is not necessarily calibration. We want to make sure that we're conservative with respect to what's actually going on. And then finally, at the end here, the sensitivity analysis, doing some variations on the model parameters to make sure we understand and have captured any key variations that might be going on to be conservative in our estimates. Now, I mentioned this biovapor model. I'm actually one of the authors of this model. It's one of a number of models available for doing these types of evidence. It's a, you know, I wrote it. It's a good balance between complexity and reasonable representation of situations. What's in here is a good representation which captures the contribution of the aerobic biodegradation we've been talking about. It's a balance between being relatively easy to use and matching a lot of field situations. The parameters that are in there, if they're hard to acquire, they're actually in a database within the model, and EPA's looked at that. Looked at this model mentioned in the EPA guides. Further on and more recently, EPA's taken the basis of the model, coded it up in this PVI screen model. It was posted, I believe, in May of last year. Been a few revisions, but that is out there and available, something that EPA ORD, Jim Weaver at EPA ORD, had put together. But very comparable to what's in the biovapor model with some extensions. What's in here is essentially the same type of conceptual framework and model as the Johnson and Ettinger model that has been widely applied for vapor intrusion, but in this case we've included this oxygen-limited aerobic biodegradation. Where the Johnson and Ettinger model might be viable are the same set of cases where this biovapor model would be applicable. There's some additional inputs in here. Because we got this aerobic biodegradation, we need some information on how the oxygen is flowing The degradation rates for the constituents, there's some factors in here for soil respiration, that's a potential oxygen sink. And then finally, we need to specify source concentrations for this model. And because there's a balance in here between oxygen consumption and availability, we need to include all the constituents, petroleum vapor constituents that are in the source, because they all biodegrade, they all consume oxygen. That's going to affect how deep this aerobic anaerobic interface is, how far the distance is that these vapors can degrade in an aerobic soil layer. So how does oxygen incorporate into the biovapor model? This is one of the nice features here, is that there's a number of different options. One way to do it is we actually go out and measure what oxygen concentration might be, either right below a building foundation, could be less than ambient levels. We could measure the depth at which the oxygen concentration actually starts decreasing. That's another option. What's nice in this model is that if we don't have that information with some site characteristics about the building, about the soils, is that it will do a balance between oxygen transport and vapor and hydrocarbon vapor transport, and essentially back out these oxygen concentrations and depths. So there's a number of factors here. Essentially what you can do is use the one that's available, and the model will balance them out so they're all internally consistent. I did mention vapor concentrations are important in modeling and modeling estimates. Because of the way the model's structured, balance between oxygen consumption and oxygen and hydrocarbon consumption, we need to include all the constituents of the vapor source. Particularly for NAPL sites, NAPL impacted sites, it's those aliphatic hydrocarbons, things that may not necessarily be significant in a soluble plume, can be high concentration in the vapors near a source. And you can input that information into the model. There are some guides, some information in the modeling documentation that will help you if you don't exactly have that data, but it is a key piece of information in terms of getting this oxygen balance right. I'm going to start wrapping this up with a comparison of this model to a couple of case examples. First example is a Utah site. This is one of the sites that Robin Davis would have put together, and essentially what you're looking at is some measured benzene concentrations and some biovapor model concentrations, the solid red line, for example, the Johnson and Ettinger models, that dashed line. What you're seeing is a pretty reasonable comparison between measured benzene concentrations in the biovapor modeling. The modeling tends to be more conservative than the measurement, but a pretty reasonable representation of what's going on here. This is one example. More information. Let's see, another example. This is the prior example. The concentrations are high, should have been a dissolved phase source. This example from New Jersey is a NAPL source at depth. It includes not just benzene, but this isooctane. And what you see is, again, a fairly reasonable representation, comparison between measured benzene concentrations, biovapor model benzene concentrations, and similarly for the isooctane. What you see for the isooctane is higher concentrations at the source, less attenuation with depth, including up to the soil surface. And so the model is also predicting different rates for different chemicals and doing a fairly decent job in the comparison here. And that's a couple examples. And it's just illustrating, in this case, lines of evidence between the modeling, between the measurement, building some support for these situations. And wrapping this up in terms of this summary is, modeling is one of a number of ways we can assess and evaluate sites, one of a number of lines of evidence. I've illustrated some use of this biovapor model. There's other models available. You need to determine if modeling is appropriate for your site and situation. Often cases, biovapor can be, maybe PVI screen may be applicable for your sites. And then finally, when we're looking at the results here, we need to make sure sensitivity's been included. Need to make sure that the conceptual site model actually matches what's going on with the model as well as what's going on with the site. And I'll wrap it up there. And next we have David Folks.
Great. Thanks a lot, George. And hello, everyone. So by now we all know that biodegradation minimizes the potential for petroleum vapor intrusion. And very often that obviates the need for mitigation, but in some cases the sources can be shallow enough and concentrations high enough that you still need to consider some kind of vapor control. So that's what we're going to talk about over the next few minutes. So to start with, the learning objectives and overview for this section. We'll begin with factors that are unique to PVI mitigation. And by that, what we mean is factors that make PVI different from chlorinated vapor intrusion when it comes to mitigation. I'll then go on to talk about the various strategies that you might consider for vapor control. And as we go along, I'll point out where you can get more detailed information about mitigation in the guidance. So let's move right into factors unique to PVI mitigation. So again, what I mean here is factors that make petroleum vapor intrusion mitigation a bit different from chlorinated problems. First of all, one of the big differences is that petroleum contamination in general is usually less extensive and easier to clean up than chlorinated impacts. And what that could mean in some cases is that you could actually remediate the source of vapors quickly enough that would address the vapor impacts. The second thing that are unique to PVI is that it's, as you know, the vertical separation distance between the source and the building matters. And if we have enough distance for bioattenuation or biodegradation, that can eliminate the pathway. So you can consider that, particularly for new construction, if you can actually create that separation distance, you may be able to deal with a PVI issue that way. And another difference from chlorinated is that, and as you've been hearing, oxygen makes a difference as well. So if we can get oxygen below a building by venting solutions, by using aerated floors or other things like that, then that will tend to promote biodegradation and help reduce potential for PVI. One last thing we want to point out is that with petroleum, of course, you can, in some cases where you've got LNAPL close to a foundation, you can have high enough concentrations to represent an explosion hazard, and you have to make sure you use the right kind of equipment in that situation. So we'll move on here. I'm on slide 106 for those of you offline to talk about vapor control strategies for PVI. And they really fall into three broad categories. The first is environmental remediation or simply cleanup as a strategy for dealing with the vapors. The second is building mitigation, which most of you probably think of when we talk about controlling vapors, and that would be like sub-slab depressurization or some technology like that. And the third category is institutional controls, where we use administrative mechanisms to prevent exposure that would be of concern. For example, institutional controls that prevent construction of buildings or a particular use like residential use. So let's pull all of this together with a few examples that you'll get a chance to participate in a moment. In this first example that I've shown here, we have a UST where there's been some releases, but the impacts are pretty much limited to the vadozone. But the impacts are close enough to the building shown that some vapors have got into the building and caused indoor air concentrations to exceed the residential screening level, but still below the commercial screening level. And just assume in this case that proper lines of evidence have been considered to come to that conclusion about the source of the vapors. So in this case, the question is what vapor control strategy should we employ at this site? And Mary, if you could pull up the polling question. So what we show on the slide and down below are different technologies and approaches you can apply. What I'd like you to do is each pick a couple, no more than three, technologies that you think are most applicable or that you would rely on principally for controlling vapors. And I'm not, in this case, I'm not talking about cleanup that you might have to do for other reasons. Of course, you probably would have to remediate the site, but I'm talking about what you would do to control the vapors or what you would rely on here. So we can see in the, you might have to scroll down a tiny bit depending on your screen size to see the bottom one, but we have a number of people voting for remediation, several looking at mitigation and some institutional controls. Okay, let's close the poll, Mary. Everyone just remember all that. And what I'm going to go to is the next slide. And what I'm showing here is what the ITRC team, what our opinion is regarding what would be appropriate. And in this case, like many of you, we think that because of the small area of contamination, that remediation might be the most efficient and applicable way of controlling vapors, just remove the source. And if that can be done quickly, then mitigation is probably not necessary. And another viable option, though, is restricting residential use since we are below commercial screening levels. So you could certainly continue to use the building for commercial purposes. Now let's go to the second example. Similar, but we have more of a problem here. LNAPL has been released and spread under the building. It's within 2 feet of the slab, so we can't use the separation distance to screen out the site. And in fact, again, measuring indoor air concentrations and applying proper lines of evidence, we conclude that we're above the residential and below the commercial screening levels due to vapor intrusion. So again, Mary, if you could bring up the polling question. I'd like you to do the same thing again. Pick the two or three technologies you would rely on in this situation to address vapors. We realize you probably will need to mitigate the groundwater, but we're principally looking at vapor issues here. Okay, so we have a few suggesting evacuation, more of an kind of an even split between remediation and mitigation, and some institutional controls down there. Okay, let's close that, Mary. So you have to remediate quickly in this business. All right. So again, the ITRC suggested approaches are, in this particular case, are that while remediation may be necessary to meet other requirements, you're unlikely to be able to do that quickly enough to address VI. So building mitigation or institutional controls would seem to be the best approach for controlling vapors. We don't think it's an emergency situation because we have indoor air levels that are below commercial, certainly not near hazardous levels from an explosion standpoint or an evacuation standpoint. And again, institutional controls may be viable if commercial use is appropriate for this building while you're remediating the site. All right, one more example. And in this case, we have the same degree of contamination, same LNAPL that would be less than 5 feet below future building foundations, but we don't have any buildings yet. The site will be developed sometime in the future. So the question is, with respect to vapors, how do we deal with them at, how do we manage the vapor issue at this site? So Mary, do your thing. And you all know what to do. And we have, say, majority going with remediation. And we've got institutional controls showing up fairly prominently, maybe a similar level as a solution for dealing with this, restricting residential use or requiring mitigation if the building is going to be occupied in the future. So I'm suggesting intrinsically safe building design, which is great if that's feasible. All right, let's close the poll. And go to the ITRC team thoughts, which is, well, we can't evacuate buildings that aren't there. Our remediation from a vapor mitigation strategy is maybe something to consider if you can do it before development, or maybe thinking outside the box, creating that vertical separation distance, whether it's 5 feet or in some cases you might decide you needed 15 feet, so you have to figure out whether that was viable or not. mitigation, and in this case it would be either preemptive mitigation or through institutional controls and evaluation and then mitigation if you needed it, but both of those are common approaches with new construction. All right. So I've talked about various strategies and technologies and approaches pretty quickly. These are talked about in more detail in Chapter 6. And also in Appendix J, there's information on mitigation techniques. A lot of useful information there that applies not only to petroleum vapor intrusion, but also any type of vapor intrusion. And as mentioned before, community engagement is always something to think about. And if anyone is going to be encountering the building occupants, it's probably going to be your team that's doing the mitigation work. So it's a very good idea for them to know who to direct questions to, how to answer questions if that's in their purview. And as mentioned before, Appendix K of the guidance has some suggestions on how to answer questions like are shown here. So in summary, this is really quick, but the important thing when you're looking at a PVI site is that there are many factors that might cause you to approach mitigation in a manner that's a little different than you would with a chlorinated vapor intrusion problem, which many of you may already be familiar with. And some of those considerations being to think about remediation as a viable mitigation strategy if you can do it quickly enough, to look at technologies, combined technologies like soil vapor extraction or venting that might increase oxygen levels and in other words, accomplish both remediation and mitigation at the same time. Consider explosion potential. Doesn't happen that often, but it can, and it's not necessarily just the petroleum vapors, but it could be methane from biodegradation. And just think outside the box. Think of all the tools and approaches you can follow. And, of course, take a look at your PVI guidance because it has lots of useful information for mitigation. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Matt Williams of Michigan DEQ.
Thanks, Dave. So hopefully now that you've attended this ITRC internet-based training, you know how to use ITRC's PVI document. And you understand the important role that biodegradation plays in the PVI pathway in contrast to what you may have known in the past for our chlorinated solvent sites. We also hope that you understand and know the value of the PVI conceptual site model and its key components. And if you need additional information, that you can find those in the appendix of the ITRC document. We hope that we've gone through and shown you how to apply the PVI 8-step process, which allows you to screen your sites for the pathway, and take action if those sites do not initially screen out, through either investigation or modeling or vapor control and site management, different opportunities as well. We also hope that you've understood when and how to engage with stakeholders throughout this process, and you also know where you can attain that extra information if you need further help. So with that understanding, we just wanted to identify and show you the map, and not necessarily the roadmap, but a map of different states that actually have incorporated or that they are planning on incorporating the ITRC PVI guidance document, either directly or through reference, or have some portion of it in statute. And you can see that it's a widely accepted document, and we hope to gain more and more states accepting it throughout the whole process. And in conclusion, before I kind of sign off and turn this back to Mary, I wanted to put a note out there that if you want more information, that there is 2 more one-day training sessions for the PVI training that are being offered. It's actually being offered as a one-day session with PVI and one day with PFAS. It's being offered in Fairbanks, Alaska. The combination is on April 23rd and 24th. And it's also being offered in Anchorage, Alaska on April 25th and 26th. For more information, check out the ITRC website, itrcweb.org, and look under the PVI and PVFAS training. Also, put a note out there, too, for an upcoming team that's going to expand on Dave's talk, and that'll expand on the PVI document that'll discuss mitigation. That team will be forming shortly, and hopefully, if you are a member, you'll get a note. If you're interested in joining, it may be one of the things that you want to look at in joining an upcoming team. So just a note out that there is a new team forming on mitigation for vapor intrusion sites. So I'll turn it over to Mary.
All right, thanks, Matt. And just in addition to what Matt was saying about that new team forming, if you'd like to find out what is entailed with ITRC membership and how you can get involved, if you go on the ITRC website at itrcweb.org, there's a membership area to take a look at, and that will provide you additional information and contacts you can reach out to as well. As we move into our second question-answer break, we have a couple more polls I'm going to pull up and would ask you to complete those before we sign off today. As a reminder, we would like everybody to complete the online feedback form. It's linked from this last slide. You can also access it over in the related URL section. And to access it from the related URL section, you click on feedback and then you click browse too. If you're someone who needs a certificate of participation today to support documentation of continuing education, once you fill out that online feedback form, there's a box for you to click at the end of that form to certify you participated today. Once you click that box and press submit, a certificate will be generated for you. If you happen to forget to click that box, just go ahead and go back into that feedback form, click the box, and press submit. I know a common question we often get is, well, what about certificates of participation for archives? We do have that available for many of our archives from 2011 forward. So if you aren't able to participate on a live training class and would like to still get continuing education and learn about the topic, you are welcome to participate on those archives. Fill out the feedback form, click that box to certify you participated, and then get that certificate of participation. Again, if you would fill out those online polls, we would very much appreciate it. We'll now move into some questions that have come in. And I believe this, at least this one question, our trainers have done a great job responding back to people of asking them, but I think this would be a question that others may be interested in as well. And it says, is a commingled petroleum hydrocarbon and chlorinated solvent plume considered a precluding factor? And Lauren, I think you had at least initially answered that, so I'll give you the first opportunity, but others are welcome to chime in as well.
Thank you, Mary. That's a really good question, and I probably wasn't clear enough during my slides. I did mention that if you do have a commingled plume, that we referred you to the ITRC 2012, I think it is, or I may be off on my years, the ITRC General VI guidance. And the reason for that is that the petroleum VI approach that we've described today, it really is not applicable to chlorinated VOCs. Now, some may view that as a precluding factor, but it's important to keep in mind that the petroleum hydrocarbons are still susceptible to biodegradation with commingled plumes. In fact, they may even provide an additional hydrocarbon source for biodegradation. So the likelihood that then is that you would be applying, you know, the chlorinated VOC approach to your site with a commingled plume to address the chlorinated VOCs. It's rare that we see petroleum hydrocarbon VI issues at commingled plumes for the reasons that we've talked about today with respect to their susceptibility to biodegradation.
Yeah, but I think the big thing there, though, is we refer them for commingled plumes to it's the 2007 document.
Thank you.
That's okay, for commingled plumes. And I think that was one of the things that we covered in our first meeting, that we kind of agreed to keep it simple as we went through this process, is that we were only addressing the petroleum compounds as part of this, and that was one of the consensus issues that we arrived at as a group and when we move forward. But it is something that we are aware of, and it's something that obviously comes up as a topic for future discussion.
Right. So I guess my point, Matt, was just that, you know, don't go backwards in time, if you will, and treat a petroleum hydrocarbon as if it's not biodegrading merely based on the presence of a commingled plume. But we do refer you to the 2007 ITRC guidance, because you are going to have to address the chlorinated solvents that are much less susceptible in most cases to biodegradation than what petroleum hydrocarbons are.
Okay, we'll move on to a next. Did you have something, George?
Sure. Good responses so far, and I think Lauren was getting to it at the end of that, is there's a lot of different chlorinated solvents. Some are susceptible to aerobic biodegradation. Ethylene dibromide, dichloroethane, which were in leaded gasoline present, are actually susceptible to aerobic biodegradation. There's work underway in terms of evaluating attenuation distances for those. Early results look like, you know, the benzene is still the driving conservative chemical. Right now, if you have those situations, it might be worth looking at those chemicals. But they do degrade aerobically, and they're not the only ones that do. Chemicals that don't degrade aerobically, like PCE and TCE, different situation. And then, you know, everything that you heard from Matt and Lauren definitely would apply.
All right, let's move on to another question. It says, most of the examples use sand or a more permeable type of soil in the example. Is clay soil comparable to what was shown in these examples?
In terms of, there's a couple of answers. In terms of the exclusion distances, the database did include more than sand, did include some loam, and I believe some clay, so there's it is included in those descriptions. More generally, diffusion rates, essentially vapor flux rates through clay, tend to be a lot lower, both for the hydrocarbons and the oxygen, but because the hydrocarbon flux is lower, just the potential for vapor intrusion tends to be less. The sand's included in the screening because it tends to be the case where the vapors are moving the fastest.
Right, this next question refers to the Utah case study with the 5-foot vertical separation distance. It says, the case study in Utah referred to the collection of outdoor air sampling. Do you know how these samples were collected and what numbers they were compared to? And similarly, for the collection of soil gas and groundwater samples at undeveloped sites, and they're referring specifically to slide 78, what would the results be compared to?
Again, good question, and this is Lauren. So the outdoor air samples, as I understand it, were collected using Summa canisters, and they would be time-weighted 24-hour samples. They generally, outdoor air samples are used to determine whether outdoor air as a background source is potentially impacting your measured indoor air concentrations. So they're not strictly compared to an indoor air screening level. They're used to determine whether outdoor air is potentially impacting the indoor. So in that specific case study, I pointed out that outdoor and indoor were similar, and given the amount of air exchange that occurs between indoors and outdoors, it provides relatively strong evidence that outdoor is a potential background source and contributed to the measured indoor air concentrations. Now, in terms of the soil gas or groundwater samples that are collected, for soil gas, if you go way back to the beginning of our webinar today, you know, the vertical screening distance was just were determined based on the assumption that once you reached soil gas, the medium of soil gas, that we would use, generally they used regulatory defaults, if you will, for migration from the soil gas to the indoor air, and therefore those soil gas data would be compared to the regulatory criteria generally that essentially don't account for any additional bioattenuation. However, it is very common when you're doing a multiple lines of evidence evaluation to really look at that vertical profile to see how quickly or if your soil gas is attenuating to provide support for sufficient biodegradation to the point that those soil gas concentrations are below the regulatory screening levels. Similarly, you know, the assumption is that groundwater will off-gas, and based on all of the data and evidence that we presented, you would expect biodegradation to occur. And ultimately, if you can demonstrate that you have 5 feet or 15 or 18 feet of clean soil, essentially, then you can assume exit based on regardless of your groundwater concentration. In the event that your groundwater is so close to the, or is less than that, those screening distances, then the recommendation would be to collect soil gas samples if feasible. If not, you may be left only with the land use restriction option.
All right, thanks, Warren. I do believe we have answered all the questions that have come in to this point. If we haven't addressed your question, please let us know by sending an email to training@itrcweb.org. Just a reminder that we do want you to complete that feedback form, especially if you need a certificate of participation. I think the feedback form was temporarily down just a few minutes ago, so if you tried it and it said service not available, go ahead and try it again. It should be up and working again at this point. If you do need that certificate of participation, make sure you click the box to certify you attended and then press submit, and then you'll receive that certificate. Thanks you so much for participating today. We very much appreciate your time. A special thanks to our trainers who not only are participating in delivering this training, but the years they have served ITRC in developing the guidance document and providing both online as well as the classroom training. If you'd like more information about ITRC or maybe interested in that new team that Matt talked about related to vapor intrusion mitigation, please check out the ITRC website for more information. That wraps us up today. Thanks for joining us, and have a great day.